Chapter 5, Foundation and Extent of the Supremacy. This is the favorable point for taking a view of the character of the papacy, its lofty pretensions and claims, and the foundation on which all these are based. The conflict waged by the 7th Gregory, and which ended in disaster to himself, but in triumph to his system, brings out in striking relief the essential principles, the guiding spirit, and the unvarying aims of the popedom. When intelligently contemplated, the papacy is seen to be a monarchy of a mixed kind, partly ecclesiastical and partly civil, founded professedly upon divine right, and claiming universal jurisdiction and dominion. The empire which Gregory VII strove to erect was of this mixed kind. The dominion he arrogated and exercised extended directly or indirectly to all things temporal and spiritual, and this vast power he claimed jura divino. This it now becomes our business to show. The Pope had now made himself absolute master in the Church. There was, in fact, but one bishop, and all of Christendom was his diocese. From this one man flowed all ecclesiastical honors, offices, actions, and jurisdiction. The pontiffs presided in all councils by their legates. They were the supreme arbiters in all controversies that arose respecting religion or church discipline. Quote, Gregory VII, close quote, remarks D'Aubigny, quote, claimed the same power over all the bishops and priests of Christendom that an abbot of Cluny exercises in the order in which he presides, close quote. And Cluny is spelled C-L-U-N-Y. And all this, as they claimed, as the successor of St. Peter. But it is unnecessary to spend time on a point so universally admitted as that the popes now possessed the ecclesiastical supremacy and professed to hold it by divine right. That is, as the successors of St. Peter, the Prince of the Apostles. But the point to be demonstrated here is that the popes, not content with being supreme rulers in the Church and having all ecclesiastical persons and things subject to their absolute authority, had the audacity to claim to be supreme in the state as well. And in the character of God's vicegerents, presumed to dispose of crowns and kingdoms, to interfere in all temporal affairs. The foundation of this power was laid when the popes claimed to be the successors of St. Peter and the vicars or viceroys of Christ, which they did, as we have already shown, as early as the middle of the 5th century. But the universal and uncontrolled dominion implied in this claim, they did not seek to wield till towards the times of Gregory VII in the 11th century. But that they did then arrogate this power in the most open and unblushing manner does not admit of doubt or denial. There exists a vast body of proof to the effect that the popes of the 11th and succeeding centuries attempted to prostrate beneath their feet the temporal as well as the spiritual power, and that they succeeded in their attempt. The history of Europe from the era of Hildebrand to that of Luther must be blotted out before the condemnatory evidence. For condemnatory of the papacy, it certainly is, as irreconcilably hostile to the liberties of nations and the rights of princes can be annihilated or gotten rid of. It has put this claim into a great variety of forms and attempted in every possible way to make it good. It taught this claim in its essential principles, and when the character of the times permitted, it advanced it in plain and unmistakable statements. It spent 5 centuries of intrigue in the effort to realize this claim, and 5 centuries more of wars and bloodshed in the effort to retain and consolidate it. It was promulgated from the doctor's chair, ratified by the synodical acts, embodied in the instruction of nuncios, and thundered from the pontifical throne in the dreadful sentence of interdict, by which monarchs were deposed, their crowns transferred to others, their subjects loosed from their allegiance, and their kingdoms not unfrequently ravaged with fire and the sword. Acts so monstrous may appear to be the mere wantonness of ambition, or the irresponsible doings of men in whom the lust of power had overborne every other consideration. The man who reasons in this way either does not understand the papacy, or willfully perverts the question. This was but the sober and logical action of the popedom. It was the fair working of the evil principles of the system, and no chance ebullition of the destructive passions of the man who had been placed at its head. And nothing is capable of a more complete and convincing demonstration. By the way, the word ebullition is spelled E-B-U-L-L-I-T-I-O-N. The foundation of our proof must, of course, be the constitution of the papacy, as is the nature of the thing, as are the elements and principles of which it is made up. So inevitably, it must be the character and extent of its claims, and the nature of its action and influence. What, then, is the papacy? Is it purely spiritual society, or a purely secular society? Well, it is neither. The papacy is a mixed society. The secular element enters quite as largely into its constitution as does the spiritual. It is a compound of both elements in equal proportions, and being so, must necessarily possess secular as well as spiritual jurisdiction, and be necessitated to adopt civil as well as ecclesiastical action. But how does it appear that the Church of Rome combines in one essence the secular and spiritual elements? For the point lies here. Well, it appears from the fundamental axiom on which she rests. There are but a few links in the chain of her infernal logic, but these few links are of adamant, and they so bind up together in one composite body the two principles, the spiritual and the temporal, and, by consequence, the two jurisdictions, that the moment Rome attempts to cut in two what her logic joins in one, she ceases to be the popedom. Her syllogism is indestructible if the minor proposition be but granted. And the minor proposition, be it remembered, is her fundamental axiom. And here Wiley capitalizes this next portion. Christ is the vicar of God, and, as such, possesses his power. But the Pope is the vicar of Christ. Therefore, the Pope is God's vicar and possesses his power. And that's the end of the capitalization. To Christ, as the vicar of God, All power, spiritual and temporal, has been delegated. All spiritual power has been delegated to him as the head of the church. And all temporal power has been delegated to him for the good of the church. This power has been delegated a second time from Christ to the Pope. To the Pope, all spiritual power has been delegated as head of the church and God's vicegerent on earth. And all temporal power also for the good of the church. And such is the theory of the popedom. And this conclusively establishes that the papacy is of a mixed character. We but perplex ourselves when we think or speak of it simply as a religion. It contains the religious element, no doubt. But it is not a religion. It is a scheme of domination of a mixed character, partially spiritual and partly temporal. And its jurisdiction must be of the same mixed kind with its constitution. To talk of the popedom wielding a purely spiritual authority only is to assert what her fundamental principles repudiate. These principles compel her to claim the temporal as well. The two authorities grow out of the same fundamental axiom and are so woven together in the system and so indissolubly knit to the one to the other that the papacy must part with both or none. The popedom then stands alone in genius, in constitution, and in prerogative. It is diverse from all other societies. The Church of Rome is a temporal monarchy as really as she is an ecclesiastic body. And in token of her hybrid character, her head, the Pope, displays the emblems of both jurisdictions. The keys in one hand and the sword in the other. Pope Boniface VIII was a much more logical expounder of the papacy than those who nowadays would persuade us that it is purely spiritual. In a bull, quote, given at the Palace of the Lateran in the 8th year of his pontificate, close quote, and inserted in the body of canon law, we find him claiming both jurisdictions in the broadest manner. Quote, there is, close quote, says he, quote, one fold and one shepherd. The authority of that shepherd includes the two swords, the spiritual and the temporal. And so much are we taught by the words of the evangelist. Behold, here are two swords, namely, in the church. The Lord did not reply, it is too much, but rather, it is enough. Certainly, he did not say to Peter, the temporal sword. He only commanded him to return it into its scabbard. Both, therefore, belong to the jurisdiction of the church, the spiritual sword and the secular. The one is to be wielded for the church, the other by the church. The one is the sword of the priest, the other is in the hand of the monarch, but at the command and sufferance of the priest. It behooves the one sword to be under the other, the temporal authority to be subject to the spiritual power. Close quote. Whatever may be thought of this pontifical gloss, there can be no question as to the comprehensive jurisdiction which Boniface founds upon the passage. It cannot be argued, then, with the least amount of truth, or of plausibility even, that this claim was the result of a kind of accident, that it originated solely in the ambition of an individual pope and was foreign to the genius or disallowed by the principles of the papacy. Well, on the contrary, nothing is easier than to show that it is a most logical deduction from the fundamental elements of the system. It partakes not in the slightest degree of the accidental, nor was it a crotchet of Hildebrand, or a delusion of the age in which he lived, as is manifest from the fact that its development was the work of 5 centuries, and the joint operation of many hundreds of minds who were successively employed upon it. It was the logical consequence of principles which had been engrafted in the papacy, or rather, as we have just shown, which lie at the foundation of the whole system. And accordingly, it was steadily and systematically pursued through a succession of centuries, and engaged the genius and ambition of innumerable minds. As the seed bursts the clod and struggles into the light, so we behold the principle of papal supremacy struggling for development through the slow centuries, and in its efforts overturning thrones and convulsing society. We can discover the supremacy in embryo as early as the 5th century, and can trace its logical development till the times of Hildebrand. We see it passing through the consecutive stages of the dogma, the synodical decree, the papal missive, and the interdict, which shook the thrones of monarchs and laid their occupants prostrate in the dust. The gnarled oak, whose lofty stature and thick foliage darken the earth, for roots abound and around. It's not more really a development of the acorn deposited in the soil centuries before than were the arrogant pretensions and domineering acts of the papacy in the age of Innocent, the result of the principle deposited in the papacy in the 5th century, that the pope is Christ's vicar. The pope's absolute dominion over priests is not a more legitimate inference from this doctrine than is his dominion over kings. If the pontiffs have renounced the temporal supremacy, it is on one of two grounds. Either they are not Christ's vicars, or Christ is not a king of kings. But they have claimed all along, and still do claim, to be the vicars of Christ, and they have likewise held all along, and still do hold, that Christ is head of the world as well as head of the church. The conclusion is inevitable, that it is not only over the church that they bear rule, but over the entire world as well, and that they have as good a right to dispose of crowns and to meddle in the temporal affairs of kingdoms as they have to bestow mitres and to make laws in the church. The one authority is as essential to the completeness of their assumed character as is the other. And the popes have understood the matter in this light from the very beginning. Some writers of name are at present endeavoring to persuade the world that the pontiffs, some few excepted, who they say transgressed in this matter the boundaries of Catholicism as well as of moderation, never claimed or exercised supremacy over princes, that this is not and never was a doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church, and that she repudiates and condemns the opinion that the pope has been invested with jurisdiction over temporal princes. But we cannot grant to Rome the sole right to interpret history, as her members grant to her the right to interpret the Bible. We can examine and judge for ourselves. And when we do so, we certainly find far more reason to admire the boldness than to confess the prudence of those who disclaim, on the part of Rome, this doctrine. The proofs to the contrary are far too plain and too numerous to permit of this disclaimer obtaining the least credit from anyone, save those who are prepared to receive without scruple or inquiry that all popish writers may be pleased to assert in behalf of their church. Popes, canonists, and councils have promulgated this tenet, and not only have they asserted that the power it implies rests on divine right, but they have inculcated it as an article of belief on all who would preserve the faith and unity of the church. Quote, we, close quote, says Pope Boniface VIII, quote, declare, say, define, and pronounce it to be necessary to salvation, that every human creature be subject to the Roman pontiff. The one sword must be under the other, and the temporal authority must be subject to the spiritual power. Hence, if the earthly power go astray, the spiritual shall judge it. Close quote. And these sentiments are re-echoed by Leo X and his Council of Lateran. Quote, we, close quote, says the Pope. Quote, with the approbation of the present Holy Council, do renew and approve that holy constitution, close quote. To that doctrine, Baronius heartily subscribes, quote, there can be no doubt of it, close quote, says he, quote, but that the civil principality is subject to the sacerdotal, and that God hath made the political government subject to the dominion of the spiritual church. Close quote. Quote, he who reigneth on high, close quote, says Pius V in his introduction to his bull against Queen Elizabeth, quote, to whom is given all power in heaven and in earth, hath committed the one holy Catholic Church, out of which there is no salvation, to one alone upon earth, that is, to Peter, the Prince of the Apostles, and to the Roman Pontiff, the successor of Peter, to be governed with a plenitude of power. This one he hath constituted prince over all nations, that he may pluck up, overthrow, disperse, destroy, plant, and rear. Close quote. The Italian priest, therefore, thunders against the English monarch in the following style. Quote, we deprive the queen of her pretended right to the kingdom and of all dominion, dignity, and privilege whatsoever, and absolve all the nobles, subjects, and people of the kingdom, and whoever else have sworn to her, from their oath, and all duty whatsoever in regard of dominion, fidelity, and obedience. Close quote. Quote, snatch up, therefore, the two-edged sword of divine power committed to thee, close quote, was the address of the Council of Lateran to Leo X. Quote, and enjoin, command, and charge that a universal peace and alliance for at least 10 years be made among Christians, and do that, bind kings in the fetters of the great king, and firmly fasten the nobles with the iron manacles of censures. For to thee is given all power in heaven and in earth. Close quote. I don't know about the rest of you who are listening to this or even reading along, but if that doesn't sound like Antichrist, I don't know what does. Anyway, continuing with the book. So speak the popes and councils of Rome. Here is not only the principle out of which the supremacy springs enunciated, but the claim itself advanced. Not in words only have they held this high tone. Their deeds have been equally lofty. The supremacy was not permitted to remain a theory. It became a fact. For several centuries together, we see the popes reigning over Europe and demeaning themselves in every way as not only its spiritual, but also its temporal lords. We see them freely distributing immunities, titles, revenues, territories, as if all belonged to them. We see them sustaining themselves, arbiters in all disputes, umpires in all quarrels, and judges in all causes. We see them giving provinces and crowns to their favorites, and constituting emperors. We see them imposing oaths of fidelity and vassalage on monarchs, and, in token of the dependence of the one and the supremacy of the other, we see them exacting tribute for their kingdoms in the shape of Peter's pence. We see them raising wars and crusades, summoning princes and kings into the field, attiring them in their livery, the cross, and holding them but as lieutenants unto them. In fine, how often have they deposed monarchs and laid their kingdoms under interdict? History presents us with a list of not less than 64 emperors and kings deposed by the popes. But it is improper to dispatch in a single sentence what occupies so large a space in history and has been the cause of so much suffering, bloodshed, and war to Europe. Nothing can convey a better or truer picture of the insufferable arrogance and pride of the pontiffs than their own language on these occasions. Quote, "For the dignity and defense of God's holy church," close quote, says Gregory the VII, that is Hildebrand. Quote, "In the name of the omnipotent God, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, I depose from imperial and royal administration Henry the King, the son of Henry, formerly emperor, who, too boldly and rashly, has laid hands on thy church. And I absolve all Christians subject to the empire from that oath by which they were wont to plight their faith unto true kings. For it is right that he should be deprived of dignity who doth endeavor to diminish the majesty of the church. Go to, therefore, most holy princes of the apostles, and what I said, by interposing your authority, confirm. that all men may now at length understand, if ye can bind and loose in heaven, that ye also can upon earth take away and give empires, kingdoms, and whatsoever mortals can have. For if ye can judge things belonging unto God, what is to be deemed concerning these inferior and profane things? And if it is your part to judge angels who govern proud princes, what becometh it you to do towards their servants? Let kings now and all secular princes learn by this man's example what ye can do in heaven, and in what esteem ye are with God. And let them henceforth fear to slight the commands of Holy Church, but put forth suddenly this judgment, that all men may understand that not casually, but by your means, this son of iniquity doth fall from his kingdom. Close quote. Quote, we therefore, close quote, says Innocent IV in the Council of Lyons in 1245, when pronouncing sentence of excommunication upon the Emperor Frederick II, quote, having had previous and careful deliberation with our brethren and the Holy Council respecting the proceeding and many other of his wicked miscarriages, do show, denounce, and accordingly deprive of all honor and dignity the said prince, who hath rendered himself unworthy of empire and kingdoms, and of all honor and dignity, and who, for his sins, is cast away by God, that he should not reign nor command, and all who are bound by oath of allegiance, we absolve from such oath forever, firmly enjoining that none in future regard or obey him as emperor or king, and decreeing that whosoever yields him in these characters advice, assistance, or favors shall immediately lie under the bond of excommunication. Close quote. The following bull of Sixtus V, in the year 1585, against the King of Navarre and the Prince of Conde, the two sons of wrath, is conceived in the loftiest pontifical style. Quote, the authority given to Saint Peter and his successors by the immense power of the Eternal King excels all the power of earthly princes. It passes uncontrollable sentence upon them all. And if it find any of them resisting the ordinance of God, it takes a more severe vengeance upon them, casting them down from their throne, however powerful they may be, and tumbling them to the lowest parts of the earth, as the ministers of aspiring Lucifer. We deprive them and their posterity of their dominions forever. By the authority of these presents, we absolve and free all persons from their oath of allegiance and from all duty whatever relating to dominion, fealty, and obedience. And we charge and forbid all from presuming to obey them or any of their admonitions, laws, or commands. Close quote. But it were endless to bring forward all that might to be adduced on the point. The history of the Middle Ages abounds with instances of the exercise of this tremendous power, of the disgrace and disaster that it entailed upon monarchs, and the confusion and calamity that it occasioned to the nations. But instead of citing instances of these, of which the history of Europe, not excepting that of our own country, is filled, we think it of more consequence here to observe that the most high-handed of these acts grew directly out of the fundamental principle of the papacy, that the Pope is Christ's vicar. If this be granted, the pontiff is as really the temporal as the spiritual chief of Europe, and in dethroning heretical kings and laying rebellious kingdoms under interdict, he is simply exercising a power which Christ has lodged in his hands. He is doing what he is not only entitled, but bound to do. And this is how they believe. Nothing could display greater ignorance of the essential principles of the papacy, or greater incompetence to deduce legitimate inferences from these principles, than to hold, as some do, that the supremacy was an accident, or had its origin in the ambition of Gregory, or in the superstitious and slavish character of the times. True, it was only at times that the papacy dared to assert or act upon this arrogant claim. In itself, the claim is so monstrous and so destructive of both the natural rights of men and the just prerogatives of princes, that the instinct of self-preservation overcame at times the slavish dictates of superstition, and princes and people united to oppose a despotism that threatened to crush both. When the state was strong, the papacy held its claims in abeyance. But when the scepter came into feeble hands, that moment, Rome advanced her lordly pretensions and summoned both her ghostly terrors and her material resources to enforce them. She trampled with inexorable pride upon the dignity of princes. She violated without scruple the sanctity of oaths. She repaid former favors with insult, and treated with equal disdain the rights and supplications of nations. Nothing, however exalted, nothing, however venerable, nothing, however sacred, was permitted to stand in her way to universal and supreme dominion. She became the Lady of Kingdoms. She was God's vicegerent, and could bind or loose, build up or pull down as seemed good unto her. In disposing of the crowns of monarchs, she was disposing of but her own. And in assuming the supreme authority in their kingdoms, she was exercising a right inherent in her, and with which she could no more part than she could cease to be Rome. Such is the principle viewed logically. The most arrogant acts of Gregory and Innocent did not exceed by a single hairbreadth the just limits of their power, judged according to the fundamental axiom out of which that power springs. But we are not to suppose that Romanists have all been of one mind respecting the nature and extent of the supremacy. On this as on every other point, they have differed widely. By a curious but easily explained coincidence, the Romanist theory of the supremacy has been enlarged or contracted according to the mutations which the supremacy itself, in its exercise upon the world, has undergone. The papal scepter has been a sort of index hand. Its motions, whether through a larger or a narrower space, have always furnished an exact measure of the existing state of opinion in the schools on the subject in question. In fact, the risings and fallings of theory and practice on the head of the supremacy have been as coincident, both in time and space, as the turnings of the vane in the wind, or as the changes of the mercury in the atmosphere, furnishing an instructive specimen of that very peculiar infallibility which Rome possesses. We distinctly recognize three well-defined and different opinions, not to mention minute shades and variations among Romish doctors on this important question. The first attributes temporal power to the Pope on the ground of express and formal delegation from God. We are, say they, Peter's representative, God's vicegerent, possessors of the two keys, and therefore the rulers of the world in both its spiritual and temporal affairs. And this may be held, speaking generally, as the claim of the popes who lived from Gregory VII to Pius V, as expressed in their bulls and interpreted, little to the comfort of sovereigns, in their acts. They were the world's priest and monarch in one person. And we repeat this, which is the high ultramontane theory, appears to us to be the most consistent opinion, strictly logical on Romanist principles, and indeed completely impregnable if we but grant their postulate that the Pope is Christ's vicar. Prior to the Reformation, there was scarcely a single dissident from this view of the supremacy in the Romish Church, if we accept the illustrious defenders of the Galatian liberties. Theologians, canonists, and popes with one voice claimed this prerogative. Quote, "The first opinion," close quote, says Cardinal Bellarmine when enumerating the views held respecting the Pope's temporal supremacy, quote, "is that the Pope has a most full power, jure divino, over the whole world in both ecclesiastical and civil affairs," close quote. Quote, "this," close quote, he adds, quote, "is the doctrine of Augustine Triumphus, Alvarez Pelagius, Holstensius, Paranormitanus, Sylvester, and others, not a few," close quote. And the same doctrine was taught by, quote, "angelical doctor," close quote, as he is termed. Aquinas held that, quote, "in the Pope is the top of both powers," close quote, and, quote, "by plain consequence, asserting," close quote, says Barrow, quote, "when anyone denounced, excommunicate for apostasy, his subjects are immediately freed from his dominion and from their oaths of allegiance to him," close quote. The second opinion is that the Pope's immediate and direct jurisdiction extends to ecclesiastical matters only, but that he possesses immediate and indirect authority over temporal affairs also. This opinion found its best expositor and its ablest champion in the redoubtable Cardinal Bellarmine. The cardinal had sense to see that the monstrous and colossal Janus, which turned a cleric or laic visage to the gazer, according to the side from which he viewed it, which sat upon the seven hills and was worshipped in the Dark Ages, could no longer be borne by the world. And accordingly, he set himself, with an adroitness and skill for which he had but little thanks from the reigning pontiff, for the cardinal narrowly escaped the expurgatorius, to show that the pope had but one jurisdiction, the spiritual, and could exercise temporal authority only indirectly, that is, for the good of religion or the church. The pope, however, lost nothing, in point of fact, by the cardinal's logic, for Bellarmine took care to teach that the indirect temporal power would carry the pontiff as far and enable him to do as much as the direct temporal authority. This indirect temporal power, the cardinal taught, was supreme and could enable the pope, for the welfare of the church, to annul laws and depose sovereigns. This was dexterous management on the part of the Jesuit. He professed to part the enormous power which had before centered in Peter's chair between the kings and the pope, giving the temporal to the former and the spiritual to the latter. But he took care that the lion's share should fall to the pontiff. It was a grand feat of legerdemain, for this division, made with such show of fairness, left the one party with not a particle more power, and the other with not a particle less than before. Bellarmine had not broken or blunted the temporal sword, he had simply muffled it. He had left the pope brandishing in his hand the spiritual mace, with the temporal stiletto slung conveniently by his side, concealed by the folds of his pontificals. He could knock monarchs on the head with the spiritual bludgeon, and, having gotten them down, could dispatch them with the secular poignard. What was there then in Bellarmine's theory to prevent the great spiritual freebooter of Rome doing as much business in his own peculiar line as before? Nothing. But Bellarmine's opinion has become antiquated in its turn. The papal scepter now describes a narrower political circle, and the opinions of the Romish doctors on the subject of the supremacy have undergone a corresponding limitation. A third opinion is that of those who hold the pope's indirect temporal power in its most mitigated and attenuated form, in so very attenuated a form, indeed, that it is all but invisible. And accordingly, the authors of this opinion take leave to deny that they grant to the pope any temporal power at all. There are the views propounded by Count de Mastier and Abbot Grosselin on the continent, and by Dr. Wiseman in this country, and now generally received by all Roman Catholics. De Meister strongly condemns the use of the term temporal supremacy to indicate the power which the popes claim over sovereigns, and maintains that it is in virtue of a power entirely and demonstrably spiritual that they believe themselves to be possessed of the right to excommunicate sovereigns guilty of certain crimes, without, however, any temporal encroachment or interference with their sovereignty. He instances the case of the present pope, who is possessed of so little temporal power that he is compelled to submit to the ridicule of the Roman citizens. De Meister conveniently forgets that the question is not what the popes possess, but what they claim, either directly or by implication. The matter is stated in almost precisely similar terms by Dr. Wiseman in his, quote, lectures on the doctrines and practices of the Catholic Church, close quote. Quote, the supremacy which I have described, close quote, says he, quote, is of a character purely spiritual and has no connection with the possession of any temporal jurisdiction. Nor has this spiritual supremacy any relation to the wider sway once held by the pontiffs over the destinies of Europe. That the headship of the church won naturally the highest weight and authority in a social and political state grounded on Catholic principles, we cannot wonder. That power arose and disappeared with the institutions which produced or supported it, and forms no part of the doctrine held by the church or held by the church regarding the papal supremacy. Quote, what sort of power then is it which these writers attribute to the Pope? A purely spiritual power, which, however, may, as they themselves admit, and must, as we shall show, carry very formidable temporal consequences in its train. Actually, that quote that I read just before that part, that was a close quote. My apologies. Let me reread that again. What sort of power, then, is it which these writers attribute to the Pope? A purely spiritual power, which, however, may, as they themselves admit, and must, as we shall show, carry formidable temporal consequences in its train? A single term expresses the modern view of the supremacy. Direction. It is not, according to this view, jurisdiction, but direction, which rightfully belongs to the pontiff. He sits upon the seven hills, not as the world's magistrate, but as the world's causist. He is there to solve doubts and guide the consciences, not to coerce the bodies of men. It is not as the dictator, but as the doctor of Europe that he occupies Peter's chair. But this is just Bellarmine's theory in a subtler form. The mode of action is changed, but that action and its result is the very same. We are led in no long time and by no very indirect path to the full temporal supremacy. If the Pope be the director and judge of all consciences, if he be, as Romanists maintain, an infallible director and judge, must he not require submission to his judgment? Implicit submission, seeing it is an infallible and supreme judgment? Suppose this infallible resolver had such a case of conscience as to the following submitted to him. And it is no hypothetical case. The Grand Duke of Tuscany solicits the papal see to direct his conscience as to whether it is lawful to permit his subjects to read the word of God in the vernacular tongue, or to permit Protestant worship in the Italian language in his dominions. And he is told, it is not. The Pope does not send a single spirito, Florence. He simply directs the ducal conscience. But the Grand Duke, as an obedient son of the Church, feels himself bound to act on the advice of infallibility. Immediately, the genus arm appear in the Protestant chapel. The Waldensian ministers are banished, and a count of the realm, along with others, whose only crime is attendance at Protestant worship and reading the word of God in Italian, are thrown into the Bargello, or common prison. The sentence of excommunication thundered from Gaeta against the Romans was the precursor of the French canon, which the Jesuits of the cabinet of the Elsey sent to Rome, or Elysi, like Elysium, sent to Rome. The excommunication was a purely spiritual act, but gaps in the Roman wall, filled with gory masses of Roman and French corpses, had not much of a spiritual character. Laws favorable to toleration and Protestantism, the succession of Protestant sovereigns, and all other acts of the same kind must be condemned by this supreme spiritual judge as hostile to the interests of religion. And of course, every Catholic conscience throughout the world is directed by the judgment of the pontiff, and must feel bound to carry that judgment out to the best of his power. Were the Catholics of Ireland to propound such a case of casuistry as this to the papal see, whether it is for the good of the church in Ireland that a heretic like Queen Victoria should bear sway over that island, well, who can doubt what the reply would be? Nor can it be doubted that Irish Catholic consciences would take the direction which infallibility indicated if they thought they could do so to good purpose. This autocrat of all consciences in and out of Christendom may disclaim all temporal power and affect to be head of but a spiritual organization. But well he knows that on the right and left of Peter's chair, as turnkey and hangman to the Holy Apostolic See, stand Naples and Austria. The knife of De Meister, fine as its edge is, has but lopped off the branches of the tree of supremacy. The root is in the earth, fastened with a band of iron and brass. The artillery of Romanist logic plays harmlessly upon the fabric of the papal power. It veils it in clouds of smoke, but it does not throw down a single stone of the building. The spectator, because it is blotted from his sight, thinks it is demolished. Anon the smoke clears away, and it is seen standing unscathed and as strong as ever. History is a great bar in the way of the reception of this theory, or rather of the general conclusion to which its authors seek to lead the public mind, namely that the pontifical direction is not connected, either directly or consequentially, with temporal power, and that the popes simply pronounce judgment in abstract questions of right and wrong, leaving their award, as any other moral and religious body would do, to exercise its legitimate influence upon the opinion and action of the age. Well, the reception of such a view of this supremacy, as this is much impeded, we say, by the monuments of history. But what can be neither blotted out nor forgotten, it may be possible to explain away. And this is the task which De Meister, and especially Gosselin and other modern Romanist writers, have imposed upon themselves. De Meister admits, as it would be madness to deny, that the popes of a former age did depose sovereigns and loose subjects from their oath of allegiance. But to the amount to which these acts embodied temporal jurisdiction or differed in their mode from direction, the adherents of the modern theory maintain that they grew out of the spirit and views of the Middle Ages, and that they were founded not on divine right, but on public right, that is, on the general consent of the sovereigns and people of those days. Now, to this view of the subject, there are many and insuperable objections. The popes themselves give quite a different account of the matter. When they pronounced sentence of excommunication on monarchs in the Middle Ages, on what ground did they rest their acts? On the constitutional law of Europe? On rights made over to them by a convention, express or tacit, of sovereigns and the people? No, but on the highest style of divine right. They gave and took away crowns, as the vicars of Christ and the holders of the keys. Well, these popes did not act as casuists, but as rulers. They did not decide a point of morality, but rather a point of policy. And one can easily imagine the measureless indignation of Gregory or Innocent, had anyone then dared to propound such a theory. How quickly they would have smelt heresy in it, and summoned the pontifical thunders to purge out that heresy. Jurisdiction they did claim then, and on the theory of infallibility, they claim it still. Nor does it mend the matter, though one should grant that that jurisdiction is of a spiritual nature, with the indirect temporal power attached. For, as we have already shown, this is but adding one step more to the logic, without adding even a step more to the process by which the act becomes thoroughly temporal. Nay, it does not mend the matter, though we should drop the attached indirect temporal power and retain only the spiritual jurisdiction. That jurisdiction is infallible and supreme, and extends to all things affecting religion, that is, the church, the popes being the judges. We have had a modern proof how little this would avail to curb the excesses of pontifical ambition. We have seen the Pope, solely by the force of the spiritual jurisdiction, endeavoring to compel Piedmont to alter its laws and to restore the lands to monasteries, and again extend to the clergy immunity from the secular tribunals. Well, even De Meister grants the right of excommunicating sovereigns guilty of great crimes. But the Pope is to be the judge of what crimes do and do not merit this dreadful punishment. And the notions of pontiffs on this grave point are apt to differ from those of ordinary men. Innocent III threatened to interrupt the succession to the throne of Hungary because his legate had been stopped in passing through that kingdom. Wherever duty is involved, there the Pope has the right to interfere. But what action is it that does not involve duty? There is nothing a man can do, scarce anything he can leave undone, in which the interests of religion are not more or less directly concerned, and in which the Pope has not a pretext for thrusting in his direction. He can prescribe the food a man is to eat, the person with whom he is to trade, the master whom he is to serve, or the menial whom he is to hire. One can marry only whom the priest pleases, and can send one's children to no school which the Pope has disallowed. He must be told how often to come to confession, and what proportion of his goods to give to the church. Above all, his conscience must be directed in the important matter of his last will and testament. He cannot bury his dead unless he is on good terms with the church. Whether as the holder of the franchise, a municipal councillor, a judge, or a member of parliament, he must give an account of his stewardship to Rome. From his cradle to his grave, he is under priestly direction. That direction is not tendered in the shape of advice, and so left to guide the man by its moral force. it is delivered as an infallible decision, the justice of which he dare not question. And to hesitate to obey would be to peril his salvation. Thus, in every matter of life and business, the church comes in. But the church can thoroughly direct a whole kingdom as she can direct the individual man. The whole affairs of a nation, from the state secret down to the peasant's gossip, lie open before her eye. Her agents ramify everywhere and can at a given signal commence simultaneously a system of opposition and agitation over the whole kingdom. Man, that sounds like Twitter. Any decision in the cabinet, any law in the Senate, unfriendly to the church, is sure in this way to be met and crushed. In directing national affairs, Rome has dropped the bold, blustering tone of Hildebrand. She now intimates her will in blander accents and politer phrase, but in a manner not less firm and irresistible than before. She has only to hint at withholding the sacraments, as the Archbishop Franzoni lately did to the minister Rosa, and the threat generally is successful. Governments cannot move a step, but they are met by this tremendous spiritual check. Let me interrupt for a moment on this. It's almost like all the world leaders that get elected. Everyone, whether it's a new president or prime minister or a one that has been reelected, they all go to Rome and kiss his ring. They bow before the Pope and they kiss it. Everyone. And let me continue. They cannot make laws about education or about church lands. They cannot regulate monasteries or take cognizance of the clergy. They cannot extend civil privileges to their subjects or conclude a treaty with foreign states without coming into collision with the church. Every matter which they touch is church, and before they can avoid her, they must step out of the world. Under the plea of directing their consciences, their power, they find is a nullity, and the real master of both themselves and their kingdom is the Bishop of Rome, or his cowled or scarlet-hatted representative at their court. Thus, there is nothing of a temporal kind which is not drawn within the jurisdiction of the Pope's constructive empire, and the, quote, purely spiritual power, close quote, is felt in practice to be an intolerable secular thraldom. Under Rome's scheme of infallible spiritual direction, things sacred and civil are inseparably and hopelessly blended. And the attempt to separate the two would be as vain as the attempt to separate time from the beings that live in it, or the space from the bodies it contains, or, as it is well expressed by a writer in the Edinburgh Review, to cut out Shylock's pound of flesh without spilling a drop of blood. The recent concordant between the Pope and the Spanish government shows what a powerful engine the, quote, spiritual jurisdiction, close quote, is for the government of a nation in all its affairs, temporal and spiritual. That concordant puts both swords into the hands of Pius IX, as truly as ever Gregory VII or Innocent III held them. Let the reader mark its leading provisions and see how it subjects the temporal to the spiritual power. Quote, Article 1 declares that the Roman religion, the Roman Catholic religion, being the sole worship of the Spanish nation, to the exclusion of all others, shall be maintained forever, with all the rights and prerogatives which it ought to enjoy, according to the law of God and the dispositions of the sacred canons. Excuse me. Quote, Article number 2 deposes that all instruction in universities, colleges, seminaries, and public or private schools shall be conformable to Catholic doctrine, and that no impediment shall be put in the way of the bishops, etc., whose duty is to watch over the purity of doctrine and of manners, and over the religious education of youth, even in the public schools. Quote, Article number 3, the authorities to give every support to the bishops and other ministers in the exercise of their duties, and the government to support the bishops when called on, whether in opposing themselves to the malignity of men who seek to pervert the minds of the faithful and corrupt their morals, or in impeding the publication, introduction, and circulation of bad and dangerous books. Close quote. The 29th article provides for the establishment by the government of certain religious houses and congregations, specifying those of St. Vincent de Paul, St. Philippe Neri, and, quote, some other one of those approved by the Holy See, close quote. The object being stated to be that there may be always a sufficient number of ministers and evangelical laborers for home and foreign missions, etc., and also that they may serve as places of retirement for ecclesiastics in order to perform spiritual exercises and other pious works. Article 30 refers to religious houses for women, in which those who are called to a contemplative life may follow their vocation, and others may follow that of assistance to the sick, education, and other pious and useful works, and directs the preservation of the institution of the Daughters of Charity under the direction of the clergy of St. Vincent de Paul, under government or the government to endeavor to promote the same. Religious houses in which education of children and other works of charity are added to a contemplative life also to be maintained. And with respect to other orders, the bishops of the respective dioceses to propose the cases in which the admission and profession of novicates should take place, and the exercises of education or of charity which should be established in them. The 35th article declares that the government shall provide by all suitable means for the support of the religious houses, etc., for men, and that with respect to those for women, all the unsold convent property is at once to be returned to the bishops in whose diocese it is, as their representatives. Here, then, is the supremacy, not as portrayed in the ingenious theories of De Maistre and Gosselin, but as it exists at this moment, in fact. Script of the sanctimonious phraseology with which it has always been the policy of Rome to veil her worst atrocities and her vilest tyrannies. Sounds like the Democrats. The document just means that the Pope is the real sovereign of Spain, and that his priests are to rule it as they please, and that the court at Madrid and the other civil functionaries are there merely to assist them. The first article of this concordat declares freedom of conscience eternally prescribed in the realm of Spain. The second decrees the extinction of knowledge and the perpetual reign of ignorance. The third takes the civil authorities bound and restricted to aid the clergy in searching for Bibles, hunting out missionaries, and burning converts. And the following articles grant license for the erection of sacerdotal stews and the institution of clubs all over the country, the better to enable the clergy to coerce the citizens and beard the government. The Concordat means this and nothing else. It is as detestable and villainous an instrument as ever emanated from the gang of conspirators which has so long had its headquarters on the Roman hill. It is meant to bind down the conscience and the manhood of Spain in everlasting slavery. And it shows that despite all the recent exposures of these men, despite all the disasters which have befallen them, and the yet more terrible disasters that lower over them, their hearts are fully set upon their wickedness, and that they are resolved to present to the last a forehead of brass to the wrath of man and the bolts of heaven. This concordat has been shelved, meanwhile, no thanks to the imbeciles who exchanged ratifications with Rome, but to the revolution which broke out at that moment in Portugal, and to the mutterings, not loud, but deep, which began to be heard in Spain itself, and which convinced its rulers that even a concordat with the Pope might be bought at too great a price. Not in the high despotic countries of Italy and Spain only do we meet these lofty notions of the sacerdotal power. In constitutional and semi-Protestant Germany, we find the bishops of the Church of Rome advancing the same exclusive and intolerant claims. The triumph of Austrian arms and of Austrian politics in the south of Germany has already made the Romish priesthood of that region predominant and led them to aspire to the supremacy. Accordingly, demands utterly incompatible with any government, and especially constitutional and Protestant government, have been put forth by the bishops of the two Hesses. Württemberg, Nassau, Hamburg, Frankfurt, all the Protestant states, and of Baden, a semi-Protestant state. The document in which these demands are contained is entitled, quote, "The Assembled Bishops of the Ecclesiastical Province of the Hauat Rhine to the Several Governments," close quote. A copy has been sent over by our ambassador, Lord Cowley, and published by order of Parliament. Its leading claims are as follows, quote, "The repeal of all religious concessions made since March 1848, quote, the free nomination to all ecclesiastical employments and benefices by the several bishops in their respective dioceses, quote, the right of the bishops to subject their subordinates to special examination and to punish them according to canon law, quote, the abolition in the exercise of the ecclesiastical penal jurisdiction of the right of appeal to the secular tribunals. This shall extend from the simple remonstrance to the removal from office and the loss of emolument. Every attempt to appeal in these matters to the secular authority shall be looked upon as an act of disobedience to the legal authority of the church, and shall be punished by excommunication. Quote, the establishment of seminaries for young boys, quote, Episcopal sanction for the nomination of masters for religious education in the colleges and universities. Quote, abolition of the right of placet of the secular authority as regards the publication of papal bulls, of briefs, and pastoral letters of the bishops to the members of the clergy. Quote, permission for the bishops to preach to the people in public and to hold exercises for the instruction of priests. Quote, permission to collect men and women for prayer, for contemplation, and for self-denial. Quote, the reinstatement of the bishops in the entire enjoyment of their ancient penal jurisdiction as against such of the members of the church as shall manifest contempt for ecclesiastical ordinances. Quote, free communication between the bishops and Rome. Quote, no interference of the secular power in questions of filling up the appointment to the chapter of canons. Quote, independent administration of the property of the church and of foundations. Close quote. Can any man peruse these two documents, appearing as they do, at the same moment in widely separated quarters of Europe, yet identical in their spirit and in the claims they put forth, and fail to see that the papacy has plotted once more to seize upon the government of the world, and that its priests in all countries are working with dauntless audacity and amazing craft on a given plan to accomplish this grand object? In every country, they insolently claim independence of the government and of the courts of law, with unlimited control of the schools. They would override all things and be themselves controlled by no one. Wow, that sounds like the Democratic Party. Rome, through her organs, bids Europe again to crouch down beneath the infallibility. How strikingly also do these documents teach that popery is as unchangeable in her character as in her creed. Amid the liberal ideas and constitutional governments of Germany, she retains her exclusive and intolerant spirit, not less than amid the medieval opinions and barbaric despotism of Spain. The glacier in the heart of the Swiss valley lies eternally congealed in the midst of fruit and flowers and sunshine. In like manner, an eternal congelation holds fast the papacy, let the world advance as it may. In the middle of the 19th century, it starts up grisly, ferocious, and bloodthirsty as it did in the 15th. As a murderer from his grave or a wild beast from his lair, so has it come back upon the world. The compilers of these documents breathe the very spirit of the men who, in former ages, covered Spain with inquisitions and Germany with stakes. They lack simply opportunity to revive and even outdo the worst tragedies of their predecessors. In Germany, they attempt by a single stroke of the pen to sweep away all the guarantees which flowed from the Treaty of Westphalia. And in Southern Europe, they strike down with the saber the rights of conscience and the liberties of states. How long will princes and statesmen permit themselves to be misled by the wretched pretext that these men have a right to commit all these enormities and crimes? That heaven has committed the human race into their hands, and that neither the rights of man nor the prerogatives of God must come into competition with their sacerdotal will. How long is the world to be oppressed by a confederacy of fanatics and ruffians who are only the abler to play the knave as they rob under the mask of devotion and tyrannize in the awful name of God? But we have no need to go so far from home as to Spain and Germany for an instance of, quote, a purely spiritual jurisdiction, close quote, transmuting itself immediately and directly into temporal supremacy. Let us look across to St. George's Channel. The British government, pitying the deep ignorance of the natives of Ireland, wisely resolved to erect a number of colleges in that dark land, in the hope of mitigating the wretchedness of its people. The priesthood discover that this scheme interferes with the church, whose vested right in the ignorance of the natives it threatens to sweep away. The Pope does not throw down a single stone of any of these colleges. His interference takes a purely spiritual direction, but a direction that accomplishes his object quite as effectually as could be done by a physical intervention. He issues a bull denouncing the Irish colleges as godless and forbidding every good Catholic, as he values his salvation, to allow his child to enter in them. This bull, given at the Quirinal, makes frustrate the intention of the Queen and renders the colleges as completely useless to the Irish nation, at least to that large portion of it for whose benefit they were specially intended, as if an army had been sent to raise the obnoxious buildings and not leave so much as one stone left upon another. It matters wonderfully little whether we term the Pope the Director of Ireland or the Dictator of Ireland. While Ireland is Catholic, the Pontiff is and must be its virtual sovereign. The British power is limited in that unhappy island to the work of imposing taxes. Imposing, not gathering, for the taxes are taken up by the priests and sent to Rome, while to us is left the duty of feeding a country which clerical rapacity and tyranny has made a country of beggars. Thus, the Pope's yoke is not one bit lighter than, instead of calling it a temporal supremacy, we call it a spiritual jurisdiction, or even a spiritual direction, close quote. It would yield, we are disposed to think, wonderfully little consolation to the unhappy sovereign whose throne is struck from under him and whose kingdom is plunged into contention and civil war, to be told that the Pope in this has acted, not by jurisdiction, but by direction, that he exercises this power, not as Lord Paramount of his realm, but as Lord Paramount of his conscience. That, in fact, it is his conscience, and not his territory, that he holds as a fief of the papal see. And that he is enduring this castigation from the pontifical ferula, not in his capacity of king, but in his capacity of Christian. The unhappy monarch, we say, would find but little solace in this nice distinction, and, even at the risk of adding to both his offense and his punishment, might denounce it as a wretched quibble. These, then, are the two points between which the supremacy oscillates, direction and divine right. It never sinks lower than the former, and it cannot rise higher than the latter. But it is important to bear in mind that whether it stands at the one or at the other of these points, it is supremacy still. We have already indicated that the temporal and spiritual jurisdictions are coordinate. This, we believe, is the only rational, as it is undoubtedly the scriptural view of the subject. The liberties of society can be maintained only by maintaining the divinely appointed equilibrium between the two. If we make the temporal preponderant, we have Erastianism, or the slavery of the church. If we make the spiritual preponderant, we have popery, or the slavery of the state. The popish element entered into the jurisdiction of the church when spiritual independence was transmuted into spiritual supremacy. This happened about the 6th century, when the Bishop of Rome claimed to be Christ's vicar. From that time, the popes began to interfere in temporal matters by direction. For it is curious to note that the supremacy, as defined in the modern theory, has come back to its beginnings, to run, of course, the same career, should the state of the world permit. At the period of Gregory VII, it ceased to be direction and became a jurisdiction, and so continued down till the Reformation. And since that time, it has been slowly returning through the intermediate stages of indirect temporal power, of purely spiritual jurisdiction, to its original form of direction at which it now stands. But the root of the matter is the claim to be Christ's vicar. Until that is torn up, the evil and malignant principle cannot be eradicated. The supremacy may change shapes. It may go into a nutshell, as some philosophers have held the whole universe may do, but it can develop itself as suddenly, and let the world become favorable, it will speedily shoot up into its former colossal dimensions, overshadowing all earthly jurisdiction and claiming equality with, if not supremacy above, divine authority. We repeat, according to the modern theory, to go no higher, all Christendom holds its conscience as a fief of the Roman See, and we trust pontifical dignities will forgive the homely metaphor by which we seek to show them the extent of their own power. The governing power in the world is conscience, or whatever else may occupy its place. And he who governs it governs the world. But the pontiff is the infallible and supreme director of conscience. He sits above it, like the driver of a railway train behind his engine. An ingenious apologist might make out a case of limited powers in behalf of the latter, showing how little he has to do with either the course or velocity of the train. Quote, he does not drag the train, close quote, some might say. Quote, he has not power enough to move a single carriage. Well, but he regulates the steam, close quote. Here is the Pope astride his famous ecclesiastical engine, with all the Catholic states of Europe dragging at his heels and careering along at a great rate. Here is the Bourbon family coach, which upset so recently, pitching its occupant into the mud, looking as new as it is possible for an old battered vehicle to do by the help of a fresh color of paint and varnish. Here is the old imperial car, which Austria picked up for a trifle when the Caesars had no longer any need for it. Here it is, blazoned with the bloody beak and iron talons of the double-headed eagle. Here is the Spanish stagecoach, hurtling along in the tawdry and tattered finery of its better days, its wheels worn to their spokes, and its motion made up of but a succession of jerks and bounds. Here is the Neapolitan vehicle, and the Tuscan vehicle, and others lumbering and crazy. And here, in front, is the famous engine St. Peter, snorting and puffing away. And here is Peter himself as an engineer, with superstition for a propelling power, and excommunication for a steam whistle, and tradition for spectacles to enable him to keep on the rails of apostolic succession and prevent his being bogged down in heresy. It would be very wrong to say that he drags along this great train. No, he only turns the handle to let on or shut off the steam, shovels in the coals, manages the valves, blows his whistle at times with eldritch screech, and catches at his three-story cap, which the wind blows off every now and then. It is not jurisdiction, but direction with which he favors the members of his tail. Nevertheless, it moves where, when, and as fast as he pleases. But something in a somewhat more classic vein would doubtless be deemed more befitting the pure and lofty function of the pontiff. The Romanists have exalted their father, as the pagans did their Jove, into an empty reign far above sublunary affairs. In that eternal calm, he issues his infallible decisions, thinking the while no more of this little ball of earth or of the angry passions that contend upon it than if it had yet to be created. Or, if at times the thought does cross the pontifical mind that there are such things in the world beneath him as cannon and sabers, and that these are often had recourse to execute the determinations of infallibility, how can he help it? He must needs discharge his office as the world's spiritual director. He dare not refrain from pronouncing infallibility on those high questions of duty which are brought before him, and if others will have recourse to material weapons in carrying out his advice, he begs the world to understand that this is not his doing, and that he cannot be justly blamed for it. Now, one cannot but wonder at the admirable distribution of parts among the innumerable actors by whom the play of the papacy is carried on. From the stage manager at Rome to the lowest scene shifter in Clonmel or Tipperary, well, each has his place and keeps it too. When an unhappy monarch is so unfortunate as to incur the displeasure of Mother Church, the pontiff does not lay a finger upon him. He does not touch a hair of his head. No, not he. He only gives a wink to the bullies who, he knows, are not far off, and whose office it is to do the business. And thus the wretched farce goes. Okay, that's the end of chapter 5. I'm actually going to move into one of the bookmarks here. In here, the notes that accompany. I don't read the notes when I read the book. If you guys want to actually learn where all this stuff comes from, I recommend actually getting the book. I think it's like a couple of bucks on Amazon Kindle. It's called The Papacy, Its Histories, Dogmas, Genius, and Prospects. It is not copyrighted. So, as a matter of fact, I don't read anything that's copyrighted. It's all in the public domain. But anyway, my point is I wanted to add one more thing to this chapter, and it involves the cardinal's oath. I'm going to read here, starting the context of the portion I want to give you in number 25, footnote number 25. In December last, 1850, Lord Palmerston addressed from the Foreign Office to Her Majesty's representatives abroad a circular instructing them to transmit copies of any concordat or equivalent arrangement between the Court of Rome and the particular government to which each representative was accredited. The replies form the substance of a blue book of about 350 pages, which has recently been published. We extract from the enclosures received by government in January last from the Honorable Ralph Abercrombie, our representative at Turin, the copy of the oath required to be taken by new cardinals in Sardinia. It entirely and for all governments settles the question of what a cardinal really is, proving him to be the sworn emissary, spy, and creature of the court of Rome. He so pledges his allegiance to a foreign prince as palpably to rescind the allegiance due to his own sovereign. I'm going to read this really slow. I mean, not really slow, but I'm going to read it to a point where you can take it in and understand that these are oaths. These oaths are still taken to this very day in this year, 2020. Today's April 13th, 2020. Okay? The cardinal's oath. I, such and such and such and such, cardinal of the Holy Roman Church, do promise and swear that from this hour until my life's end, I will be faithful and obedient unto St. Peter, the Holy Apostolic Roman Church, and our most holy Lord, the Pope, and his successors, canonically and lawfully elected, that I will give no advice, consent, or assistance against the pontifical majesty and person, that I will never knowingly and advisedly to their injury or disgrace make public the counsels entrusted to me by themselves, or by messengers or letters from them. Also, that I will give them any assistance in retaining, defending, and recovering the Roman papacy and the regalia of Peter. All my might and endeavor, so far as the rights and privileges of my order will allow it, and will defend against all their honor and state, that I will direct and defend with due favor and honor the legates and nuncios of the Apostolic See in the territories, churches, monasteries, and other benefices committed to my keeping, that I will cordially cooperate with them and treat them with honor in their coming, abiding, and returning, and that I will resist unto blood all persons whatsoever who shall attempt anything against them, that I will by every way and by every means strive to preserve, augment, and advance the rights, honors, privileges, the authority of the Holy Roman Bishop, our Lord, the Pope, and his before-mentioned successors, and that, at whatever time, anything shall be devised to their prejudice, which is out of my power to hinder, as soon as I shall know that any steps or measures have been taken in the matter, I will make it known to the same our Lord, or his before-mentioned successors, or to some other person by whose means it may be brought to their knowledge. Quote, that I will keep and carry out and cause others to keep and carry out the rules of the Holy Fathers, the decrees, ordinances, dispensations, reservations, provisions, apostolical mandates, and constitutions of the Holy Pontiff Sixtus of happy memory as to visiting the thresholds of the apostles at certain prescribed times according to the tenor of that which I have just read through. Quote, that I will seek out and oppose, that is, persecute and fight against, heretics, schismatics, against the same our Lord, the Pope, and his before-mentioned successors, with every possible effort, when sent for, from whatever cause, by the same our most holy Lord, and his before-mentioned successors, that I will set out to present myself before them, or, being hindered by a legitimate impediment, will send someone to make my excuses, and that I will pay them due reverence and obedience. That I will, by no means, sell, bestow away, or pledge, or give away in fee, or otherwise alienate, without the advice and knowledge of the Bishop of Rome, even with the consent of the said chapters, convents, churches, monasteries, and benefices, the possessions set apart for the maintenance of the churches, monasteries, and other benefices committed to my keeping or in any way belonging to them, that I will forever maintain the constitution of the blessed Pius V, which begins Ad Mone and is dated from Rome on the 4th of the calendars of April of the year of our Lord's incarnation, 1567, and the second of his pontificate, together with the declarations of the holy pontiffs, his successors, particularly of Pope Innocent IX, dated at Rome the day before the nones of November of the year of our Lord's incarnation, 1591, of the first of his pontificate, and of Clement VIII, of happy memory, dated at Rome on the 16th of the calends of March in the year 1592, and the 10th of his pontificate on the subject in the matter of not giving away in fee or alienating the cities and places of the Holy Roman Church. Also, I promise and swear to keep forever inviolate the decrees and incorporations made by the same Clement VIII on the 26th day of June of the before-mentioned year 1592, on the 2nd day of November 1592, and on the 19th of January and the 11th day of February 1698, in the matter of the city of Ferrara and the whole duchy thereof, as well as respecting all other cities whatsoever and places recovered by him, and which fell in by the death of Alfonso of happy memory, the last Duke of Ferrara, or otherwise to the Holy Roman Church and Apostolic See. Also the decrees and incorporations made by Urban VIII of happy memory on the 12th day of May 1631 respecting the cities of Urbino, Eugibio, and Carli, Joris Pronium of the whole Duchy of Urbino, as well as in the matters of the cities of Pisari, Cinghiale, South Leo, St. Leo, and the state of Montefeltro, the Vicariate of Mondovi, and of the other cities and places whatsoever recovered by and having devolved to the Holy Roman Apostolic Church by the death of Francis Maria, the last Duke or otherwise. Also the decree of incorporation made in Consistory on the 20th day of December 1660 by Alexander VII of happy memory in the matter of the Duchy of Castri in the state of Ronciglione and other places, lands, and properties sold to the Apostolic Chamber by Rimutius, Duke of Parma, and the constitution of the same Alexander VII of happy memory, with reason of and allocation upon the decree for incorporations of this kind published on the 24th of January 1660, together with the confirmation, innovation, extension, and declaration of the other decrees and constitutions of the Holy Pontiffs, issued in prohibition of parting with them in fee, and in no way and at no time, either directly or indirectly, whatever cause, color, or occasion, even of evident necessity or utility may present itself, to act against them or to give advice, counsel, or consent against them in any way, but, on the contrary, always and constantly to dissent from, oppose, and reveal every device and practice against them, whatever may come to my knowledge by myself or by any messenger, immediately to His Holiness or His successors, lawfully entering under the penalties in case of neglect or disobedience contained in the said constitutions or any other heavier ones that it may seem to fit His Holiness and before mentioned successors to inflict. I will not seek absolution from any of the foregoing articles, but reject it if it should be offered me, or in no way accept it when offered. So help me God and these most holy gospels. This double translation stands so in the parliamentary book, and the original is Omni Contuper Sectorum Metempugnatrum. I'll spell it out for you guys who can speak Latin. OMNICONATUPERSECUTURUMETIMPUGNATURUM. So, as you can see from this Oath of Allegiance, the papacy is without question the biblical Antichrist. Without question.